coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK, the internet radio of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of England. I'm your host, Jamie Krieger. I am pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church in Cambridge. At Resurrection, we have adult Bible study at 10 a.m. every Sunday while the children are in Sunday school. At 11 a.m., we gather for the Divine Service with Holy Communion. For more information about our congregation, go to resurrectionlutheran.org.uk. I'm also pastor of the Oxford Lutheran Mission. Pastor Tapani Simeoki and myself take turns to meet with the congregation there at 4:30 in the afternoon at St. Michael's and All Angels every second and fourth Sunday of the month. For more information about this, go to oxfordlutheran.co.uk. If you are nowhere near these congregations, go to lutheran.co.uk. This is the website of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of England, and it has information about all our congregations in England, Wales, and Scotland. I am also manager of Lutheran Radio UK. I hope you enjoy listening to our programs as much as we enjoy producing them for you. Find our entire schedule and the podcasts of all our programs at lutheranradio.co.uk.
Welcome back to Worth Doing Badly, this weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year. Today we will be looking at the lessons for the seventh Sunday after Pentecost, which is this coming Sunday. And the lessons are from the Old Testament, from the book of the prophet Isaiah, chapter 44, verses 6 through 8. The Psalm is 119, verses 57 through 64. The epistle lesson is from Romans 8, verses 18 through 27. And the gospel lesson is from Matthew 13, verses 24 through 30, and then 36 through 43. And here's our speaker, David Weber. David, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to hear from you, Jamie.
It's good to hear you too. So what's going on in our lessons today?
Well, it would seem like I'm focusing on a minor thing in the Matthew passage, but I think it is actually more essential than what would appear. The passage says, while they were sleeping, the enemy sowed weeds among the wheat. Now, this is the second week in which we're dealing with the nature, with agriculture, particularly what happens with seeds. In both cases, the seed and the plant are vulnerable, and it looks like it's unlikely that a seed is going to survive. And then once it becomes a plant, it looks like it's not going to survive. So the way that Jesus is telling these parables is to have us think about life being subjected to all sorts of forces that would kill it and how vulnerable life is. All right, so in that background, it struck me as really interesting that the people responsible for growth were sleeping. Now, if you look in the Old Testament, there are psalms in which you enter into sleep. Psalm 4 actually talks about sleep as bearing witness to trust. There's a connection between those who can sleep in peace and being able to trust that God is caring for us. So I think that image of sleep is at work here. And so I ask the question, how can you sleep when wickedness threatens life and livelihood? Because that's what this parable is about. The sower, who is now a farmer, has enemies, and the enemies are out to ruin his life and livelihood, and yet he is sleeping. And we know from the Gospels that sleeping seems like apathy. That's what the disciples thought of Jesus while he was sleeping in the boat while the boat was being rocked by wind and waves. And so sleeping looks like the wrong thing to do. It looks like it's irrational. We think that if you're being threatened like this, you need to get busy posting guards or pulling weeds. But it's not the case. Sleeping is one of the ways in the scriptures that we wait to give the seed or to give the soul time to grow. There are certain good things that simply do not come to us unless we wait. We cannot grow a seed if we're continually checking on the progress of the seed's growth. It has to sit there quite apart from our intervention and our control. And yet, waiting while life-wrecking evil is busy causing weeping and gnashing of teeth is difficult to the extreme. It sounds like living by the gospel, living by God giving us his gifts in his time. It sounds easy. All you do is wait. But you know, waiting can be one of the most difficult things in the world. We experience this every time our sleep is frustrated by worry. We would like to take control of the thing, but we can't. We have to wait. And as much sleep as is frustrated these days, people are experiencing the difficulty of living by in a world in which we depend upon the grace of God. We would like God to act more swiftly. We would like his gifts to come in a more pronounced way. And yet we are left to wait. This is what it's like with things that grow like grace. And when you live in a world of gifts, waiting is essential. And sleeping is one of the ways in which we wait for God to ask, to act in order to bring his gift of life to fruition. Seeds and souls need time to grow. And yet we see in our lives, we worry because we see how vulnerable this growth is. We think we make a little bit of progress that can be threatened in a breath. And yet, we're meant to experience astonishment that the seeds still will outgrow the weeds. Harvests eventually will take place when we are to be involved in reaping the benefits. But it is astonishing. And that's why I think we express our astonishment at the world of growth, the world of grace, when we eat our daily bread with gratitude and we sleep in peace. These may not seem like great expressions of our confessions, but this is how on a daily basis we begin to experience a world in which God promises to care for us. And so that's the focus of this parable. And we see that focus being a little bit differently, but addressed in the psalm, where the psalmist says, "Grant me grace as befits your utterance." So in other words, the psalm, already anticipating the world of that Jesus would usher in by his death and resurrection, this world of grace in which God continues to come to us with his gifts. But the psalmist knows that he's going to have to wait for it, and he waits for this by praying. So joining sleeping and eating, praying is one of the ways in which we wait for God to act, to intervene with his grace. And while he is praying, the psalmist says, he prays that God would call his attention to God's word, to his utterance. So the psalmist already recognizes in the psalm that waiting is difficult to the extreme, especially when the cords of the wicked ensnare me, he says. But rather than being overwhelmed with the strength of the wicked, the psalmist waits for grace by hastening, not to action. He hastens rather to observe God's utterances, commands, and words. So I don't want to make believe that this is obvious, but the fact is that he is able to wait because in his time of waiting, he is paying attention to God's word. And it somehow, that's the purpose of the waiting, to get us familiar with God's promises and then let time run its course. And we see if these promises are fulfilled or if we're left disappointed. And the psalmist assures us that although we may fear the disappointment, in the end, God continues to keep his word. Now, it's not as if the psalmist is at ease. He mentions that even if I rise at midnight. So, in other words, he doesn't just fall asleep and rest in peace and quite the opposite. He rises at midnight, and yet he expects, when he can't sleep, that God will meet him and to quote, teach me your statutes. So, in other words, all through this waiting, God is there with his word, and the effect of that word is that the psalmist knows the Lord's kindness fills the earth. That's the truth. The kindness that we enjoy when the seed outgrows the weed and becomes the harvest. Every time we eat, we enjoy the kindness that fills the earth and then fills our stomach. Every time we sleep, we are enjoying the kindness in which a life continues even when we have lost absolute control. So for the psalmist, study is not a duty that he does. So often you hear people say that you ought to study God's word. That doesn't make sense to the psalmist. You study not as a duty. You study because that's what you do when you're waiting for time to run its course. And in that study, God reveals his care for his creation. So studying for the psalmist is in a category with sleeping and eating and enjoying the world. It is the way that we as Christians wait for God to act. So now in Isaiah, we have the same idea of waiting a little bit differently. Isaiah puts it into the context of fear, and he says, "Do not be afraid." The reason why we can't wait, the reason why we intervene, the reason why we want to act is that we are afraid if we don't do something, then it's all going to blow apart. But to Isaiah, God says, "Do not be afraid. Have I not informed you?" So in other words, even when we're in circumstances that make us sleepless, God's intent is to teach us, to inform us, to have us aware of what he is doing in this world. Now, and I often see these passages, do not be afraid, and I wonder, how is it for people in those circumstances not to have fear, not to be sleepless, not to be anxious, when it looks as if, as with the prophet Isaiah, his life was spinning out of control? And then what Isaiah would have us say, pay attention to is that the only reason life, we can think that life is spinning out of control is because life has been settled and life has been controlled before it started spinning out of control. Who was responsible for this settled and controlled life? Do we actually think that God, having first ordered the chaos of creation, is now letting the chaos take over? When we fear that God is letting his beloved creation return to the primordial chaos. Is that really what's happening? No, Paul will say later, no, God is subjecting the creation, he's subjecting our life to an element of chaos, to an element of futility, not in order to crush us, but in order for us to become informed as to what he is doing. So the way that Isaiah understands this, he says that don't fear, because you have to recognize, this is what God's saying to Isaiah, that the Creator is also the world's Redeemer. And God is not a passive Redeemer. He will act as the Lord of armies, he says. So we fear because we think that as time unfolds, chaos and not redemption will prove to be the more powerful. We fear because we think that God, who started this whole thing, has somehow abandoned it, rather than that this is all part of God's redemptive process. To fear is to deny the fact that God reveals himself as the first and the last, and that there is no other God. There is no one else in this universe that is controlling the universe. And as it was in the beginning, the order that God had created, even though it may seem that it's spinning out of control, it is not. There is no other God capable of actually ruining the universe. So as it was in the beginning, is now, and it will ever be. So fear not, is what Isaiah is told. The God who first ordered the world is now continuing as the world's redeemer, and this will continue until the end in which all other competing forces are put to rest. That is why we don't need to fear, even when we are in the grips of fear. It is at least comforting to know that our fear is irrational. It doesn't need to be. But fear is one of those things that we just can't choose to turn off. We can't choose to turn off anxiety. We just, again, have to wait for God to work in our lives through His Word and through His Spirit. But that's the promise. And so it's not, it's one of those things that we just never give up expecting that God can continue to work in us in bringing about, trusting in His ongoing care. And then this brings us to Romans. It would be very hard for me not to want to turn my attention completely to this passage, because Paul, who fully understood the experience of suffering, does not let that suffering determine his identity. In fact, when Paul weighs his experience of suffering, he says it is irrational to think that it can be compared to the glory that is going to be revealed. Even in the thick of suffering, Paul recognizes that this is preparing for a glory that will eclipse all of this suffering. He recognizes that his suffering is like a labor pain. It is, when you're in the thick of it, it feels like death. But you know, having seen it happen over and over again, that it is that labor pains are eventually overwhelmed by new life. I think the birth of the first child is remarkable. I think it's almost miraculous that the mother is willing to give birth to several children. That knowing full well that there is such a thing as labor pain, that does not stop her from wanting to be a participant in this overwhelming glory of new life. That's how Paul sees his suffering. From the many times that he had seen labor pains transformed into the brilliant excess of overwhelming joy of a new life, almost immediately, the pain is forgotten. So when time has run its course, and we are participants in the birth of a new life, the pain will be an afterthought. The pain actually will be part of the brilliant joy of the new life. So our lives follow the trajectory of birth. It's the trajectory of life itself, in which suffering and pain is a small but important part. Futility is real, but it's temporary. And Paul says that God is subjecting the world to this short futility in order for us to experience ourselves, for us to experience within our lives how life is stronger than death, how the seed is stronger than the weed, how growth takes over when in a world that's filled with weeping and gnashing of teeth. When you hurt until the moment the hurting stops, and then life begins, and that hurt is a thing of the past. So Paul uses another example here. He switches from the labor pain, and then he talks about hope. And Paul spent a good share of his time in prison, and he speaks about hope in the midst of hurt, and that the groans that he heard in those prison cells. The groans of tortured prisoners could be heard by Paul as prayers for God's presence. The torturers thought that they were defeating and killing death by inflicting their torture. Paul says, no, the groans that you hear there, that is not an admission of the success of the jailers. That is a prayer that the Spirit is offering up, waiting for God to reveal his presence. The world that that these jailers would like to create is filled with weeping and gnashing of teeth, but the Spirit takes their groans and turns it into anticipation for God to enter into as Redeemer. So Paul's hope is not for some far off thing. Hope is palpable. It's experienced immediately. Hope knows that the unseen is not unreal, and soon it will be seen when time has run its course. In the meantime, hope continues to groan out its prayers for the new life. And Paul says, the wait is worth it. We will not be disappointed. So, Jamie, we began with a kind of paying attention to how the farmer could sleep while all of these things were taking place. And it brings us back to Paul in recognizing that the world we live in, the weeping and the gnashing of the teeth, the anger and the sorrow that so much of the forces are aimed at, they will simply become part of a long story or a long unfolding in which they play a minor but important part in God bringing forth life to us. But again, as I said, that sounds glorious. It sounds desirable, but we are now in the thick of the time of futility. We are now in the thick of the labor pains. And so we just pray that the Spirit would use the word in order to allow us to wait patiently for the unveiling of God's redemption.
And on that note, we take our leave from today's episode. David, thank you very much. And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in. We hope you enjoy listening to these programs as much as we do enjoy producing them for you. David and I will be back here at this same time. Stay tuned. Goodbye.
Goodbye.